Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the Court. For the record, my name is Bernard O'Donnell, and I am here on behalf of Jeremy Robinson, who was convicted in the Superior Court of a drug offense and a firearm offense. I'll get right to the issue here because I know the Court is familiar with the facts. And the issue is that there was a stipulation in this case that the defendant had previously been a stipulation that the defendant was prohibited from possessing a firearm. The stipulation between the prosecutors and defense counsel. Specifically, the stipulation, which was entered into the record, was the State of Delaware and the defendant, Jeremy Robinson, by and through his attorney, hereby stipulate to the following fact. On or about November 22, 2011, the defendant, Jeremy Robinson, was a person who was not legally permitted to possess a firearm. That fact was uncontested at trial. However, what happened at trial is that the defense was concerned that at first the trial court was reluctant to give a limiting instruction to the effect that first the trial court was reluctant to remove the language from the indictment that the defendant was convicted of a felony offense consistent with the stipulation, since that was not a contested issue at trial. And thereafter, the trial court was reluctant to provide a limiting instruction that a felony conviction could only be considered as for the purpose of credibility evaluation rather than to infer a propensity to commit crime.
Why are you using the word reluctant? I thought the Superior Court decided not to do either of those things.
Well, the Superior Court, what happened was it was during the overnight recess, the trial court expressed its reluctance about, unless you give me authority, told Mr. Malik, unless you give me authority, he says, I'm not going to give a limiting instruction. I'm not going to give a limiting instruction. Give me authority that I'm required to do so. The next day, they proceeded into the proceeding, and that wasn't addressed again. But the trial court says gave an instruction says to the jury, notwithstanding the fact that the state was okay with a limiting instruction, but this is what the trial court gave an instruction to the effect of the jury, in order to find the defendant guilty of possession of a firearm by a person prohibited, you must find that all of the following elements, and one of them, the second element was, the defendant was prohibited from purchasing, owning, possessing, or controlling a firearm because he had been previously convicted of a felony. The parties have stipulated or agreed that the defendant was a person that was prohibited from purchasing, owning, possessing, or controlling a firearm, and therefore this element, the parties agree, has been established. So the trial court advised the jury that the defendant has been previously convicted of a felony, and the parties have stipulated to that fact. And at that point, there was no limiting to instruction.
All right, what do we do about the case law that suggests that it's improper to craft an instruction which does not state all the elements of the crime, whether they one of the elements has been stipulated to or not? Why don't we start with, is the statement that you just read in the instruction about a felony, using the word a felony, mm-hmm. is that part of the essential element of a crime?
Yes, but that can be stipulated as a way, and in fact in the Carter decision, which resulted in a reversal in 2005, the party stipulated to that fact that the defendant was prohibited from possessing a deadly weapon or a firearm. In that case, the fact that the defendant had been previously convicted of a felony went to the jury in the written instructions, although the trial court in its verbal instructions did not advise the jury that the defendant had been previously convicted of a felony. That resulted in a reversal because the jury was advised of information that it should not have been provided. It was extraneous of the record, and the trial and the jury was not given a limiting instruction in Carter to the effect that they could only consider that for credibility and not to infer a propensity on the defendant to commit crime. That would be, says clearly, says on point. The parties stipulate that the other. Now, I agree. If there is an instance where there is a defense stipulation to the fact that, and a defense and state stipulation to the fact that the defendant was prohibited from possessing a firearm or deadly weapon, and defense counsel got up in closing argument or whatever and started talking about, now, ladies and gentlemen, has the state presented any evidence to you that the defendant was prohibited from, if they attacked that element of the offense, then the deal's off, you know, so to speak. Well, but that didn't happen in this case.
Well, is the statement that the basis for being prohibited results from conviction of a felony part of the element of the offense of possessing a firearm while being a person prohibited?
It is part of the element of the offense, and federal cases have addressed it, well, Old Chief for one, and there are different interpretations of Old Chief. Some courts interpret it as dicta. The parties in that case stipulated that, well, the state wanted to introduce evidence concerning the prior offenses that prohibited the defendant from committing, from possessing a firearm.
Yeah, and that's not an issue here.
No, the defense in that case, I think, stipulated that he was previously convicted of a felony.
We're solely focused on the jury being told that he, in order to be found a person prohibited, he had to have been convicted of a felony, where the parties have stipulated, in effect, it's not necessary to tell the jury that, but the judge gave the charge anyway.
Correct.
Is it any different than if we were talking about degrees of burglary and the party stipulated that the state didn't have to prove that the burglary occurred at night and the trial judge instructed on the level of burglary, whether it's second or first, I actually don't recall, and the jury never heard that as a matter of fact it occurred at night. It was not argued to them that it occurred at night, and they weren't instructed that it occurred at night. Would that be error?
No, the jury would be instructed if there was a stipulation to the fact that it occurred at night. Effectively, the jury is being provided the information that it occurred at night, and that is one of the elements of the offense, and it's not in dispute.
So no one would argue under those circumstances that the jury instruction should include the statement that it occurred at night.
I hope not.
In order to convict of that level of burglary.
No. And in that case, there's probably not so much prejudice as the defendant being, as the jury learning that the defendant is a felon. In addition, what's important in this case, too, and in all of these cases, is that this situation was, unfortunately, bereft of a limiting instruction. I concede that if the judge said that the judge advised the jury inadvertently that the defendant was convicted of a felony, that element has been established, it'd be an altogether different case, I'd be arguing here, if the judge then said, but even if the defendant was convicted of a felony, you are not to use that information to infer that the defendant is a criminal or has criminal propensities and therefore committed this offense. You are only to use that to evaluate his or her his credibility. That would be an altogether different case and a much weaker case that I'd be arguing this morning.
Could you explain why, assuming you're correct, it was not harmless error?
Well, we believe it was not as harmless error, Your Honor, because there are cases, certainly, where harmless error occurs, where based upon says, the quantum of evidence on one side, the state or prosecution side, is so high, and the evidence from the defense side is so de minimis that a appellate court can weigh evidence and determine that a jury's decision would not have been affected, says, by the error.
Right, I understand what the standard is. Tell me why it's not met here.
Well, the second part of that is that why it's not met here is the defendant took the stand and testified that he admitted to the police officer that he had found the weapon in an alleyway and hid it in the house because, well, he just found it. Didn't use it. And that was because the police, after he denied knowing anything about the weapon, the police officer told him that, well, you know, we can test that weapon, DNA, fingerprints, or whatever. You know, if it comes back and we connect it to a homicide or a killing unsolved, you could be in a lot of trouble. And he testified that at that point, he was scared, and the defense argument was that he was coerced. So essentially he was saying that his statement to the police was a product of coercion and fear, and it should not be believed, and that his testimony in court. So what we have here is a credibility question. Now, if the quantum of evidence is physical evidence, everything, but if the quantum of evidence is based upon, says, credibility, we believe
where,
the court...
Where did they find the gun?
The gun was found in the broiler portion of, I guess, a range, the lower broiler portion of a range, which, you know, I don't know, I'm not much of a chef, but I never go there.
In whose home?
It's hard to say whose home. It was, the home was titled in an ex, his mother of his child, but she hadn't lived there for more than a year, and the home was unoccupied, or appeared to be unoccupied. He had a key to the home, but it was unknown who else had keys to the home, or it was basically unsecured. So that was, it was a pure credibility question here. Who to believe? Now, we know this is the trial court, at one point said, when they were questioning about whether there should be an instruction, a Lally instruction concerning the statement, his statement being unrecorded, the trial court observed that, in fact, my view of the evidence is that it probably would have. Effectively, the trial court was saying, and that's at page A14, that the trial court believed the police officers and not the defendant. But that's not the test of, says, harmless error, what the trier of fact believes. It's the question of whether the evidence could possibly have contributed to the verdict. And if the evidence here that should not have been admitted, that he was a felon without any limiting instruction as to the purpose, the limited purpose for which the jury could use that information, with
the evidence that was admitted that he was a felon, there wasn't any evidence that he was a felon.
No, pardon me, there was not. The trial court instructed the jury that he was a felon. I'm sorry. But that's as, considering that trial, the juries are presumed to follow judicial instructions, that's more powerful than evidence. If the court permits, I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
You may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. I would like to begin by apologizing to the court for the state's failure to have produced the relevant court exhibit earlier in this process, and takes full responsibility for that. In this case, it really comes down to a harmless error analysis. The defendant testified that he was a drug dealer. He testified that he had lied to the police. There was no mention in any of the arguments or in presentation of evidence.
Well, and before we get into the harmless error, we need a predicate error. So the error that you're acknowledging would be the failure to give a limiting instruction or including the word felony. Or both?
The state's position is that the parties and the court had agreed not to mention felony. That was the last decision that the parties all agreed, and the court represented to the parties that that was happening in agreement with the parties. And in fact, the indictment language that was read as part of the jury instructions did not include any reference to that. When the court went to describe the elements, the state had to prove the felony was mentioned. In light of the fact that the state drafted the original stipulation and didn't have the parties, the defendant stipulate that he was a felon, and that the final agreement was to not use that, the state's position is that that should not have been included at that point in time. No one noticed, apparently, that the jury instructions were inconsistent with the agreement of all the parties in the court. So at the end, there was no application for a limiting instruction, presumably because no one noticed the single line in the jury instructions that said, that mentioned the word felony.
Did the trial judge tell the parties that she was going to include the word felony in the instructions?
The court exhibit one, in that the court indicates that the changes requested, taking out felony, have been done.
Did counsel see the written instructions before the jury was instructed?
Given that that was done overnight, I'm not sure, Your Honor. So the state would say that the court, that the parties believed that that was not going to be said, and consequently there was no additional request for a limiting instruction prior to the jury instructions. After they had agreed to take that word out, it would be unnecessary, and then at the end no one noticed.
But I thought the court asked for authority on the question of whether the recitation of the elements of the crime should eliminate the word felony.
That is correct. At that point in time, the state prosecutor was advocating that the word felony should be included, and the court advocate was saying that that should be included. The state agreed. And then the court asked for case law. That didn't happen because the state then agreed that that should come out.
Okay, so that's why there wasn't any case law submitted, because the state agreed not to use the word felony.
Presumably that is why, because it became an agreement among the parties.
And that's what the email explains.
Yes. So because there was a general agreement, there was no more discussion on the point. So the state can only interpret the jury instructions as having an inadvertent error where it was changed in one location and not in another.
Well, was it error because the law prohibits it, or was it error, in your mind, because it was contrary to the agreement that the litigants had reached?
Contrary to the agreement the litigants had reached. A lot of the cases that discuss the fact that you can't stipulate away an element are cases where the state opposed actually having a stipulation, and the court or didn't like the wording of the stipulation and wanted to pursue presenting evidence.
What do we do about what I'll refer to probably generously as a line of cases from this court that repeat the phraseology, something along the lines of, the jury is entitled to a correct statement of the law. Even if the parties don't ask for it, a judge is supposed to know the law and to instruct in accordance with the law. So assume for a moment, for the sake of argument, that the parties agreed to what the email says they agreed to. But if that's an incorrect statement of the law, isn't the trial judge obligated to give the jury an instruction that is consistent with the law, irrespective of the agreement the parties have reached?
If the agreement the parties reached is an incorrect statement of the law, I would agree entirely, Your Honor. But I would also agree, or maybe not agree, I would also argue that if the court is in agreement with the parties and acknowledges that that is how the court is going to proceed, then that affects the ability of the parties to litigate their case. And if the court doesn't tell them that they are going to give a different instruction than the agreed instruction, then that becomes a problem for the parties.
That makes sense.
So in my view, if the court is not going to allow a stipulation that just says someone is a person prohibited as opposed to someone is a convicted felon, then that needs to be clear at the beginning of trial, because that will certainly affect the strategy of defense counsel in particular, and it would be an ambush otherwise.
So why was it harmless error?
The harmless error in this case is because the defendant himself got on the stand and acknowledged that he was a drug dealer, which is a felony, that he wasn't very good at it, but that wasn't too important. But then he also agreed that he had told the police that he had touched the gun, he had taken the gun and put it in the house, and then he got on the stand and said, well, no, I was lying. I had never really touched it. But there was plenty of evidence there about the defendant.
Well, wait a second. Let me back up for a moment. Did the defendant at any point try to avoid the statement that he is or was a drug dealer? In other words, was he consistent on that point?
He was consistent on that point. He was consistent that he had gone in the house. He was consistent that he had the drugs in his pocket. And he agreed that he had told the police and that it was true that he wasn't a very good drug dealer.
What was his defense?
His defense was centered entirely at that point on, I lied to the police and because I was scared and I didn't really touch the gun.
So that was his defense. We would agree that his credibility was an issue.
He tried to put his credibility at issue, yes. Now, interestingly enough, defense counsel, in preparation for putting him on the stand, had acknowledged that he did have prior felony record, more than one, and was planning on putting him on the stand, or the defendant was going to take the stand, and there was a discussion about what could be used to impeach him, and defense counsel had asked for simply, could we not say the name of it, could we say that it was a felony, and the court had agreed to do that. The state, out of an abundance of caution, because of a prior ruling by this court in a factually different type of case, that you cannot do that, that in order to use a felony for impeachment, you have to say the name of the felony. The state elected not to even go there when the defendant took the stand. So there was no mention of any felonies whatsoever, other than one line in the jury instructions that was clearly inadvertent in light of the email. And given the defendant's consistent testimony that he was a drug dealer, it does not appear that this would have changed the outcome in the case.
In other words, the jury would understand that a drug dealer is a felon?
Yes. If the court has nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Well, we'd agree with the state that the jury is entitled to a correct statement of the law, but we'd also like to add that a limiting instruction under 105 as to how the jury can use information that the defendant has been previously convicted of a felony is also a correct statement of the law. And the court, I think over the past 25 years, since at least counting back to Weber in 1988, has reversed about 10 cases for that reason, because the jury was not instructed accordingly as to the limited purpose of that information.
What about
in this case either.
What about your client's own testimony that he's a drug dealer?
Well, that was admitted, and we don't just question that.
Right, but in terms of the jury is hearing from his own mouth, I'm a drug dealer, and then later on, the jury is hearing that in order to be convicted, yada, yada, convicted felon. Why is that more impact than his own testimony?
Because the jury is being informed that not only did he have drugs and he sells them, but he was previously convicted of a felony. And there were, off the jibip, so to speak. What felony has this guy been convicted of? Has he shot somebody before? Is he a paroled murderer? Is he a sex offender? It opens up the door insofar as potential prejudice without a limiting instruction. He acknowledged that he had drugs. The drugs were found in his pocket. He acknowledged that he sold a little bit of drugs. He wasn't very good at it. But the sole contested issue in this trial was possession of the firearm. And there was evidence from the police that he admitted that he found it in an alleyway and brought it into the house. But he testified at trial that he was scared at that point by the police, and he felt coerced into making that statement because he thought he would be in more trouble, and then actually didn't know about the gun. So there was a credibility issue about whether the statement from the police should be given more credibility, or his testimony before the jury in court. So it was a pure credibility issue, and as the court observed in Williams, the Williams case, if the 803 Atlantic 2nd, 2002, Williams, because this case hinged on credibility, we cannot say that the prosecutor's improper remarks were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So no matter where the preponderance lies, whether we'd like to believe police officers as opposed to someone who admits he sells drugs and is not very good at it, we prefer to believe police officers, that's the province of the jury. And the court has previously recognized in Williams that when the case hinges on credibility, it can't be harmless error.
But the problem I'm having, and maybe I'm off base here, the problem I'm having is that when you have a credibility question, it's because some evidence points in one direction, other evidence points in the other. And it's a question of who you believe, right? And when you're deciding that question, when the jury's deciding that question, the jury may be affected, let's say, by knowing that the person, the defendant, has committed other crimes, right?
Yes.
But here the defendant says, yeah, I'm committing crimes, possession and sale of drugs. So why would it matter if the jury then hears in a definitive way, yeah, you know, the guy's a convicted felon?
Well, it matters because the jury is informed that he was previously, it says, convicted of a felony, and we don't know what felony, and the jury hasn't been given a limiting instruction as to the fact. So it says in that case, you know, if a defendant is accused of, says, dealing drugs or any other offense or possession of drugs, and the state can introduce all kinds of extraneous information to impeach his character, and we can, at that point, we'd say it's always harmless because this guy's a drug dealer. So why should the jury ever believe him? And that's not consistent, we believe, with the authority of the court, which was concisely addressed in the Williams decision in 2002. This case hinged on credibility. It was a narrow issue, but it was a credibility issue. And I recognize that any one of us, any member of the court, any member of the jury, may have thought, huh, the guy's guilty, I believe the police, I believe this guy is lying now on the stand, but we can't be the 13th juror. We have to evaluate the information that the jury receives at the time. And I guess it's the right to jury trial, not, you know, our own individual assessments of credibility. It's the trial court recognized that, well, wait a second, you know, who believes what he's saying? But, you know, that's not the law. The jury is entitled to make that call.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.